On this week's 51%, we'll hear from Ken Burns on his soon-to-be-aired documentary about the Roosevelts. On Eleanor Roosevelt,
she is the most consequential First Lady in American history.
Then, a documentary currently in production on the Lost Girls of Sudan. And moving from screen to sound, we'll hear from an audio engineer with a mission. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Oscar-nominated and Emmy Award-winning filmmaker Ken Burns has tackled topics as diverse as baseball, the Civil War, and Prohibition. This time, the film is The Roosevelts, An Intimate History. It's a 7-part, 14-hour documentary directed and produced by Burns and written by longtime Burns collaborator Jeffrey Ward. The film interlaces the stories of Theodore, Franklin, and Eleanor Roosevelt, three members of one of the most prominent families in American politics. It airs on PBS in September. Burns was at the Franklin D. Roosevelt Presidential Library and Museum in Hyde Park, New York, earlier in the summer, where I caught up with him. I asked Burns what is different about his approach to the Roosevelts and the resulting film.
I think the most interesting thing is, in some ways, to me, the most obvious, which is this is about all three of them. And while there's tons of stuff, films and books on TR and FDR and FDR and Eleanor and Eleanor, there's nothing that connects them as the family drama it is. This is the story of three individuals all born with the last name Roosevelt, and the complicated stories of their upbringings, the complicated traumas of childhood, particularly for Theodore and Eleanor, the imposition of infantile paralysis at age 39 for Franklin, all of the complicated relationships that develop have not been told in quite this fashion. And so the more familiar outer top-down version of the past of world wars and depressions and other political and social and military events are given full coverage here, but we now see them from the point of view of very complicated individuals that, though they might be as bold-faced names as you get in the American political hierarchy, they are nonetheless made familiar because their issues are human and understandable and familiar. There's divorces and there's illnesses and there's betrayals and misunderstandings and love and devotion. And so you can step back and realize that this family, the Roosevelts, have touched more Americans than any other family in American history. And that's a new way to begin a familiar story.
What is the biggest relevance in the story you were telling to today?
I think in almost any film we've done, we're reminded, as Ecclesiastes says, that there's nothing new under the sun, that we're always, human nature remains the same, that there were always playing out these things of human beings reacting to the random chaos of events. But it's particularly true of the Roosevelts, both Theodore and Franklin, as well as Eleanor. They are asking fundamental questions, the very questions that we ask in our own political circumstance today. What is the role of government? What can a citizen expect from that government? What is the nature of leadership? How does character inform leadership? How do traumas of life, the asthma and tragedies early in TR's life, the being orphaned and being so just oppressively insecure in Eleanor's case, polio in Franklin's case, how do they contribute to character and in turn to that leadership? What is the nature of heroism? Is it, as our media culture suggests, some sort of perfection? No, it's, as the Greeks have told us, a combination of very obvious strengths and maybe not so obvious weaknesses. And so our film is about the negotiation, sometimes the war, the inner war between these characters, these three high voltage personalities, between their strengths and their weaknesses. And that's actually, as the Greeks have been telling us, what defines heroism. Achilles had his heel and his hubris. So there's the Roosevelts are sort of history firing in all cylinders. And what I've found from an entire professional life devoted to American history is that it's very often exactly contemporary. In every way, they're talking about things that we're dealing with today.
Tell us something we didn't know about the Roosevelts that you yourself didn't know going in.
You know what? I never make films about stuff that I know. Me telling you what you should know is like somebody giving a homework assignment. I don't want this to be homework. I want to take a subject that I want to learn about and share with you the process of discovery. So everything was new. I mean, one of the startling things as a Lincoln man, having worked with the Civil War for years and years and years, is just how high Franklin Roosevelt rose in my estimation as president, almost to a parity with Abraham Lincoln. I didn't think anybody would be able to compete at that level of just how amazing Eleanor is. She's right on almost every subject. The only thing she ever got wrong was prohibition, but you can give her a pass on that because her father was a hopeless alcoholic. She watched her younger brother, who she felt responsible for, die in the throes of delirium tremens. You could understand how she'd think that banning alcohol would be a good thing, which it wasn't. But everything else, on race, on poverty, on women, on Japanese internment, she was right about everything and was this idealistic voice that spoke into the much more pragmatic politician, FDR's ear. That's great. And that TR is the real authentic genius, the only really true genius I think we've had as a president of the United States. And that comes with great possibilities and also some very complicated undertow. And I was honored to get to know him and to try to balance both that incredible genius and the dysfunction and the agitation and almost the depression and sometimes near madness that attends that. Theodore Roosevelt livens up page after page of history, but every one of the 7 episodes, 14 hours, is about saying to people, this is a different view of the Roosevelts. And so almost every episode is, I hope, brand new.
Eleanor Roosevelt often is just summed up as a strong woman. I was hoping you could speak more about what you learned and compared to first ladies today of recent history.
She is the most consequential first lady in American history. There's obviously a comparison to Hillary Clinton for a variety of reasons, some very obvious and having to do with policy and some also having to do with the personal issues that both of these very strong women have had to deal with in relationship to their husbands. The magnificence of Eleanor is that this is a terrified young orphan girl, a fate of mice, other people, grown-ups, the dark, everything, who suddenly realizes her mother, who dies early, had called her granny because this mother was a great beauty and she was disappointed in Eleanor's looks and called her granny. And so she lived a life of just crushing insecurity, but found if she could be useful to people, she might earn their love and respect. And so just like Theodore in his own way, just like Franklin in his own way, these people who could have spent their lives frittering away fortunes actually spent their lives sort of attesting to this very interesting calculus. That is to say, we all do well when we all do well, and look to try to bridge the gap between incomes, something we deal with today, to try to help those less fortunate to ourselves, something 100% of all Americans feel. They were also trying to level the playing field because fairness is something that all Americans also feel. And you can disagree with the way they did it, but the impulse is pure and genuine, and getting to know them, and particularly her and her heart, her capacious heart, is one of the great delights of my professional life.
Finally, why did you do this now?
You know, we've been talking about it for a long time. We've had many, many other films that have crossed paths with Theodore and Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. My writer, my longest time collaborator, Jeffrey Ward, is the writer of the script, and he's also an author of 2 magnificent books about the early life of Franklin Roosevelt. And he and I have been discussing it for decades. And originally it was just going to be Franklin, and then we just said, no, let's do them all. Let's try to understand them. I mean, for a long time, Franklin was trying to hit every mark that his much more famous fifth cousin had met. And if you look at the trajectories of both their careers, they're eerily similar. And that's because Franklin is this ambitious, without much substance, guy trying to just be what his president cousin is. And then polio strikes. He would have been the presidential nominee. He'd been the vice presidential nominee in 1920. He would have been the presidential nominee in 24 and would have been wiped out by Calvin Coolidge, and we'd never hear of FDR. He'd be a footnote in history. But struck by infantile paralysis, he had to spend the 20s rehabilitating himself and rehabilitating this political career. And when he does, he's able to come back, the man at the moment in the midst of the Great Depression, and lift this country out of its depression with his own supreme inner self-confidence and good humor, and with his great political cunning, and with his own courage to overcome his deficits. And this is one of the greatest stories in all of American history.
While addressing an audience at the FDR site in Hyde Park, Burns says the film is unprecedented in terms of television.
There has never been an instance where a network has taken over an entire week of prime time and then some to show one film. I think it's an indication of their excitement. I think it's also, more importantly, an indication of the centrality of the three Roosevelts to our lives today.
The first episode of The Roosevelts, An Intimate History, airs on PBS September 14th, running 7 consecutive nights. Ken Burns is director and producer.
Life is just a bowl of cherries. Don't take it serious. It's too mysterious. You work, you save, you worry so, but you can't take your dough when you go, go, go. So keep repeating.
Now we turn to a documentary currently in production about the lost girls of Sudan. Veronica Balderas Iglesias reports from Colorado.
Imagine that one day you were playing with your friends and a bunch of soldiers showed up and ordered you to leave as soon as possible or else they'd kill you. Well, that's what happened to me and a lot of kids.
That's an excerpt from a new documentary, The Dawn Will Break, which is currently in production. It tells the story of some South Sudanese young women who, after fleeing the government's ethnic cleansing in the early 1990s, were rescued from a refugee camp in northern Kenya by German nun Sister Louise Rademeyer.
They think when a child is an orphan, they have the right to do with that child what they want. And they would just sell these young girls off to anybody for money to go drinking and enjoy life.
Miklena Peter is one of the co-producers of the film. She's also the first of the so-called lost girls who eventually benefited from a U.S. refugee relocation program. She arrived in Colorado in 2003 with only a pair of clothes, her Sudanese high school diploma, and transcripts from the international relations courses she took at the American University in Nairobi. After living for some time at a foster home in Aurora, her eagerness to continue her education drove her to apply and be accepted at the University of Colorado in Boulder.
It's not easy to move from one continent to another and to adjust so easily like that. One thing, the culture was different, and even up to now it's still different.
She now has a double major in political science and women and gender studies. And on May 9th, she got her master's degree in educational foundations policy and practice. She says she loves life in Boulder and is grateful to all the sponsors who have volunteered their care, time, and resources to help her achieve her goals.
I'm not lost anymore. I'm in the U.S., I'm a citizen, and I got to connect with my family and I established myself. I've empowered myself enough to an extent that I can now extend the help to empower other people like me. I have a project of building a South Sudanese American school for women, and we are working on that. We are now raising money to build that school, and we wanted to go and support girls to go to school and be strong and be able to empower themselves and advocate for themselves.
Even if Miklena manages to raise the $500,000 that are needed for the Tori School project, the most pressing challenge to launch it in South Sudan is the security situation. There is ongoing political infighting, and the newest country in the world has topped the list of fragile states in this year's index released by the Fund for Peace. Refugees International warns of a catastrophic humanitarian crisis in South Sudan, with some 50,000 children in danger of dying this year, according to UN estimates. While the situation improves, Miklina is still volunteering at the Boulder-based nonprofit she founded, the Community of South Sudanese and American Women and Men.
We help those who come through the refugee camps in Africa. South Sudanese who were in refugee camps like in Kakuma and are also orphans. We pay their tuition before, and we buy them books. We help them with stipends for rent. We provide internet. We provide cell phones. We used to provide also health care. And then we help them with mentorship.
The CISO organization is currently helping 18 young women, most of whom are in the process of graduating. Among them is Elizabeth Achulo, who is currently working as a student assistant at the National Center for Women and Information Technology of the University of Colorado in Boulder. Like Miklina, Elizabeth is one of the lost girls, but that is a term that she and the other South Sudanese women wish to shed.
Everybody wished that they were in their country, they live peacefully and have everything they want. But then, unfortunately, where I come from, it's not the same situation. So I'm kind of happy that I got this chance to come here and graduate from my university. Most of my, most of the girls my age who I left behind don't have that chance. I don't find myself lost anymore because I have found my way out through all the darkness, and now I'm here.
To be able to help refugees who relocate in the U.S. have successful stories such as Elizabeth's and hers, Miklina recommends that the resettlement programs include more detailed cultural orientations and that former refugees are recruited to help the newcomers.
Recruit South Sudanese who have been in the U.S. for some time, who know how the refugee life was, so that they use the experience they were in to help other people. You can bring an American to help, but that person can give the help, it's not going to be enough. You needed someone, when I come here, I needed someone who can speak the same language I speak. That way I can find myself so easily relating to that person.
Elizabeth hopes that more Americans show interest in the crisis of South Sudan.
We are all part of human race, and for you to know what's going on in the other part of the world, you need to seek and like know. And if you meet someone who is from another place, and maybe if you are interested, like wanting to know more, ask them, and they maybe they tell you their story.
Dawn Will Break is expected to be released by the end of this year, provided that Miklina and her partners find experienced editors willing to support the project on altruistic grounds. The producers are also raising additional funds to create a multimedia educational package for high schools and colleges throughout the U.S. They say they want to generate meaningful dialogue on issues such as genocide and racial persecution. For KGNU, Veronica Valderas Iglesias.
From a mission on the screen to a mission in sound. When you hear about STEM or science, technology, engineering, and math, do you think about audio engineers? Terry Winston does. According to some estimates, 95% of all audio engineers are men. But that's changing, as Jen Cheehan reports from San Francisco.
You're an inspiration to all of us.
I'm in.
Right then, who's next?
Pick me.
Yes, the little Sheila down the front.
Woo!
Come on up here.
In a darkened room, 12 middle school girls are watching a scene from the animated Pixar movie Finding Nemo. This isn't a slumber party. It's a class. The girls are paying close attention to the movie with their pens poised over notebooks. But what they're paying attention to isn't what they're watching. It's what they're hearing. When the clip is over, their teacher, Kelly Coyne, asks a question.
Great. So, I'm looking for raised hands for different sound effects you heard.
Water.
Yeah, so when the fish were moving around in the ocean, was it silent?
No.
What else? There's something in the water that we heard a bunch.
Bubbles.
Bubbles, yeah. So different bubbling sounds.
Coyne explains how those bubbly, swishing water sounds help bring the story to life. The girls nod in understanding. After they learn about sound effects, they're going to add their own sounds to a cartoon.
Ooh, you guys can take turns being SpongeBob.
The girls here are students from a public school in San Francisco's Mission District, but this is a special off-campus class called Girls on the Mic. After splitting up into small groups, they gather around computer workstations to record.
It needs to be in input mode. So you see under dialogue, it has that I. That I needs to be clicked.
Oh. Girls on the Mic is run by Women's Audio Mission, an organization dedicated to teaching the recording arts to women and girls.
We're in the control room of Women's Audio Mission, so we're the only professional recording studio in the world run entirely by women.
That's Terry Winston. She founded Women's Audio Mission 11 years ago when she was a professor of recording arts at City College. She first learned to work with sound as a musician.
You know, I'm an old punk rocker, so that's where I started out.
She's also an electrical engineer, or as they say in the biz, a double E.
Double E electrical engineering, sorry.
That's the insider lingo.
It's totally insider. It's funny because there's a lot of audio people that are double E's, so we bond over it.
Winston is part of a rare club. Women make up only a small fraction of all double E's. She's a self-admitted gearhead. She is really into microphones.
And they all sound different. They all look different. Different materials, different transducers inside. I mean, it's like wine. You know, when people talk about wine and they're so obsessed, it's like that's kind of how I am with microphones.
Winston knows her kind of obsession is still unusual for girls, but it's something she wants to see more of.
Girls are not socialized to be the gadget people. Just seeing them with a microphone is just the most crazy, empowering thing to witness. And it's like, the amount of energy that comes out of that is better than caffeine. It's incredible.
Winston says music and sound are perfect as a way of getting girls interested in subjects they might not approach on their own.
If we say we're going to teach you math today, or we're going to teach you science today, or the physics of sound today, you know, they're going to run for the hills. But if we say, okay, let's, you know, listen to this, you know, Rihanna song, and then let's break it down. And, oh, musical principles are based on math. Hey, this is 4/4, and this is how you count it. Sound is such a natural introduction to physics. And it's so easy to explain because analog technology is so easy to explain. The air moving is so easy to explain, you know, to a middle school girl. We love doing that.
The girls take their new physics and math skills and use them. They make sound for movies.
Okay, my turn.
They create their own podcasts.
Good morning, Bay Area. This is your fave news reporter, Rosemary, of Channel 2 News. Today, we have discovered that scientists in Washington, D.C. have discovered a new infectious disease, and the symptoms are meowing, biting people, and becoming a zombie cat. Now, I'm going
They even record their own songs.
Yo te di todo mi amor, pero lo echaste a la basura.
Terry Winston says unleashing creativity and thinking critically are just as important as mastering the technical stuff.
I think my science and engineering training, it really taught me to be a problem solver and to be really self-sufficient, and also to be very confident that when there's a problem, I don't run away from it.
That can-do attitude is at the heart of Women's Audio Mission. Winston says there are a lot more women in the industry now, but there's more work to be done. She still runs into people who underestimate her just because she's a woman.
It happens all the time. But I think it happens just as much to somebody at Starbucks. Or, you know, I think it's a pervasive thing. I chose to start Women's Audio Mission to focus on the thing that I knew really well. And I knew that we could change it.
How do you mute it?
Winston says that change starts from the ground up with these girls sitting in groups at recording stations. The next generation of brilliant problem-solving gearheads may just come from right here.
What do you do to press record? It's not just space bar, right?
It's command space.
Yep.
Ready?
No.
Yeah. go.
And go.
I'm friends with the monster, the son of my bed.
On the mic, I'm Jen Sheehan for Cross Currents.
You're trying to save me, stop holding your breath. And you think I'm crazy, yeah, you think I'm
And that's
crazy.
Our show for this week. Roll credits. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1309.